Welcome to Monday. Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke here with a veteran journalist of old and new media. Longtime CBS reporter and anchor Dan Rather is big on social media. His blog News and Guts has 1.5 million Facebook followers. The average News and Guts post gets more likes, comments, and shares than posts from CNN and BuzzFeed. Dan Rather still in the game. He's got a new book, too, called What Unites Us. Welcome to Seattle, Dan.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much for having me this morning.
You have a lot of young fans on social media in their 20s.
I'm grateful for every one of them.
What were you like at that age?
I certainly wasn't into social media.
No?
At that age, I was pretty much into journalism. I've always wanted to be a reporter.
How young?
Girls and football.
Girls and football.
Yeah.
You wanted to be a reporter from what age?
As far back as I can remember. For what reason, I've never been certain, but I've always dreamed of being a reporter. And when I was 5 and 6 years old, I told my mother that that's what I wanted to be. Both my parents were avid newspaper readers and discussed things in newspapers. Now, we're talking about the time was the 1930s during the Depression. The place was Texas. Neither of my parents finished high school. But they were really into newspapers. My father used to say, the newspaper is the poor man's university. And I think what must have happened as a very small child, seeing my parents read papers and discussing newspapers, I came to believe it. They must be something important. That's the best I can guess. But I've been very lucky, as I say, because I've always known what I wanted to do. There was a short period when I first got out of college, I wasn't sure I could make a living at it, as you know. Well, you probably don't know, being on public radio where they pay so well, but generally speaking, journalism doesn't pay all that well.
I've only heard, yeah. So what would you like to say to a generation that didn't grow up with newspapers but follows your news blog, News and Guts, on Facebook or where they find you? What do you want to say to a younger generation?
Well, part of what I want to say is, listen, I have no special wisdom.
None?
Practically none. I can't think of any.
Uh-huh.
But I'd like to start a conversation, particularly with young people, about what patriotism is. We're now fairly deep into the 21st century. And when people talk about patriotism, what is patriotism? And particularly to point out the difference between patriotism and nationalism. Part of the heart of patriotism is a certain humility. Part of nationalism is a certain conceit and arrogance. And the problem with nationalism is that extreme nationalism is very dangerous, particularly for a society such as ours. Nationalism can very easily slide into nativism. And then from nativism, it's not a long trip down to tribalism. And in our country, which is based on the whole idea that we can be multi-religious, multi-racial, multi-ethnic, and still hold ourselves together around some core values, that we can't descend into tribalism. If we do, we are finished as a country as we know it. Now, we're not at that point, but we're at a very dangerous point.
I want to know about how dangerous a point. I want to remind listeners that you were at the assassination of John Kennedy. You covered the Watergate scandal, the Nixon resignation. You reported from Vietnam battlefields. How dangerous a point do you see America at right now?
Well, I think we're at a very perilous point. And a lot depends on whether we, this generation, does what our fathers and forefathers did, and that is get a grip, lower our voices, dedicate ourselves to being steady, because by any reasonable analysis, we have a new president who tends to have an authoritarian style, and the tone and tenor of his presidency so far, and I don't see this as a partisan political statement, is not normal.
So then do you think that we have the conditions in the country where we can, as you say, get a grip and be steady? Or if conditions,
I do.
You
do.
Why?
That's the reason I wanted to do the book, because we have so many things that unite us. It's easy, given the daily headlines and the flow of what passes for news sometimes, to believe, well, we're just coming apart at the seams because we have these important divisions. We're still divided on race. It's easy to forget that we have these things that also hold us together. We are an empathetic people. We also are an audacious people. We believe in rule of law. We believe in right to vote. These are things that unite us, and there are many more of them, and they're much more powerful than the things that divide us. But we have too many leaders who want to exploit our divisions for their own partisan, political, and ideological reasons. And therefore, if we aren't careful, we will concentrate on what they want us to concentrate on, and that is the differences, the divisions, rather than those things that unite us.
Well, you have always been in the business that is supposed to help us not be caught up in the wants and manipulations of the parties and the powerful. You're from the press. And I want to talk about the state of journalism. You did a Netflix interview a few months ago in which you said the standards of journalism have suffered.
The mark of a good American reporter for a very long time was, how hard does he or she try and how often does he or she succeed in setting aside their biases? That was the way you were judged. All out the window now.
American reporters setting aside their bias is all out the window now. Are you talking about the New York Times, CBS, who?
Well, we're talking about journalism as a whole. There certainly are exceptions. I admire much of what the New York Times is doing, particularly their deep-digging investigative reporting. Washington Post has been almost completely revived with its investigative reporting. But what I'm talking about as a whole, American journalism, particularly the watchdog role for journalists, is under unrelenting attack by some of the most powerful political forces in the country, including President Trump. President Trump regularly attacks on a personal level individual reporters. He regularly attacks some of the best institutions of journalism in the country using such phrases, and I submit to you these are very dangerous phrases, phrases like, you know, all these people in the media, which is his word for press, are, quote, enemies of the people.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
That quote resonates through history because it's the kind of thing almost identical to what Mussolini, Hitler, and a long list of dictators have said. I want to make very clear, I am not equating Donald Trump with those figures from our past. I am saying that if you follow the natural course of things and he continues these attacks, which is no sign he's going to lower them or reduce them, this can be a danger because there is a power in the presidency. And as I say, the consistent application of that power to undercut the press's credibility, particularly the press's credibility to call him to account. If you've noticed that frequently these attacks on the press follow some story that reveals something about the president or his administration he doesn't like. You know, this is a problem for journalism and for journalists, and we are to blame for some of it. We make our mistakes. I've certainly made mine. But I do think that if people stop, take a deep breath, sort of relax for a minute and think about it, that most Americans understand that a free and independent, fiercely independent when necessary, press is the red beating heart of freedom and democracy, because it is a check on power.
So if you were back in the game, you're the CBS White House correspondent, and you have a chance to question, confront, you pick the word, President Trump, school your young colleagues. What would you say in that room?
Well, my young colleagues don't need schooling. Most of them are better educated and smarter than I ever was. But I take your question. Among candidates for the first question to ask President Trump, and it's very important to ask the question and then follow up, keep following up with the question, is, Mr. President, of what are you afraid? You have indicated by word and deed that you're very afraid of something, that you have all the earmarks of a terrorized person about the special counsel or the press is going to find out something we don't know. And, Mr. President, I don't mean to lecture you, but I say respectfully, it would be better to get out front with it now. So what is it? You tell me what your fear is. What is it you're most afraid?
That's amazing. Aren't you introducing a premise he can easily bat away? I'm not afraid. What are you talking about, rather?
And I would say, well, let me point out the following things that you have said and done, which indicate that you are very afraid. Firing the FBI director, for example, talking about firing the special counsel. Mr. President, I don't want to be confrontational. I'm trying to be helpful to you and to the country. Look me in the eye. Let's talk. What is it is you're so afraid of? Because we've got a country to hold together here. So that would be a line of question I'd be interested in.
What do you suspect President Trump is afraid of when it comes to the investigation into collaboration with Russia? You have been, you've, as we said, you were there with Watergate. You've been here before and many other American conflicts. What is your sense about this Russia scandal?
Well, first of all, we need to know more. And Special Counsel Mueller, he knows a lot more than he's letting on now. We're eventually going to find out. And answer your question, I simply don't know. Here are the key questions. It's not arguable. It's a fact that the Russians sought to meddle in our election. That's true. What we don't know is whether that was done with any conspiracy involving anybody around President Trump. And even if that was the case, was he, the president, involved in any way in a conspiracy to help the Russians meddle in the election? That's the central thing when I say I don't know where this investigation stands now. Again, the president's given indications that he's very afraid of something in that area is going to be discovered. But once we do know as much as we're going to know about whether the president was involved or not, if the answer turns out to be the worst, then we have a constitutional crisis and a crisis for the country of what to do about it. And then beyond that, how do we heal ourselves after that? You asked me my guess. I learned a long time ago that he lives by the crystal ball, learns to eat a lot of broken glass, and I've eaten more than my share over the time. But I think that we're going to possibly face some constitutional crisis over this, and it may not come as late as when the special counsel comes forward with what he's found, that there certainly is a possibility that President Trump will decide to try to fire Mr. Mueller. And if he did that, that also would touch off a constitutional crisis.
So do you think Republicans would oppose President Trump in that constitutional crisis, the Republican Party?
Frankly, I have my doubts. And I think this is something I find many people haven't taken into consideration. Unless the evidence shows something that is the equivalent of treason or very close to it, I don't see a Republican House of Representatives voting articles of impeachment against a Republican president. When Bill Clinton was impeached, he won the trial in the Senate, but you had a Republican House and a Democratic president. When Richard Nixon was threatened with impeachment, you had a Republican president and a Democratic House. Now you have a Republican House, a Republican president, and a Republican-dominated Supreme Court. It's going to be very difficult to impeach President Trump, whatever the evidence turns out to be. I know many people, I'm sure you do, who can't stand President Trump and are just saying, listen, he isn't going to last. One way or the other, he'll either resign or he'll be impeached. Well, while all of that could happen, I don't think at the present moment on what we know, that's the way to bet it.
Yes, that voice is Dan Rather, longtime CBS reporter and anchor, 24 years as the anchor of CBS Evening News. And now he has this production company. I call it a news blog, mainly News and Guts, which gets a huge audience on Facebook. I'd like to ask about all the powerful male hosts that we're hearing about sexually harassing, in some cases physically assaulting women. You've been that powerful and beloved, and help us understand why Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and others, why do these powerful men in this high-profile positions, why do they do that?
Well, I'm going to try to answer the question, Bill, but keep in mind, you know, I'm a reporter who got lucky. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. What you're seeing in terms of high-profile news people, the Charlie Rose case and some others, is a reflection of the society as a whole, that the position of men in power in newsrooms was pretty much what it was in corporations, in unions, up and down the line. And the mores, if you will, the standards of the workplace through the 50s when I first started in journalism and all through the 60s and 70s, was clearly a situation in which powerful men could pretty much do anything they wanted to do and feel he could do it with impunity. That reflected the society as a whole. I'm not excusing anybody. What we do know, and I think I was slow to come around to this, we're at a point now of tidal change. This is the day of reckoning. This is going to change. and answer your question, of course, in newsrooms, I would see things. I never saw anything to the extent that is now being exposed. I can truthfully say that, you know, in terms of rape or near rape, I never saw that. An environment in which people, men, would sometimes put their hands where they shouldn't do without permission, say things that they shouldn't say, particularly to much younger women. Yes, that happened in almost every newsroom I worked. It was, and this is not an excuse, quote, just the way things were.
The way things were. Did you ever engage in behavior that you knew was inappropriate or wrong then, or that you realize now was not right?
Well, the one thing is that there were times that I could have and should have spoken up. I want to repeat, these are things that were seen as acceptable at the time. But if I had been the man I wanted to be, I would have spoken up and said, taken the person aside and said, listen, don't do that. I didn't do that. Beyond that, I can't think of anything. And if I could, I would say so. But here's the important point, I think, that we're going to move forward now. I think the tide has turned, but that doesn't mean that it's going to change everything instantly. And what I worry about, Bill, is I think in the most high-profile jobs, whether it's a network anchor or a CEO or a union leader, now, in the highest-profile places and with the highest-profile jobs, things will begin to change. But down below, in the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, for the woman who is a waitress at the diner or the woman who makes the beds in the hotel rooms, it's going to be a while. It may be a long while before they will be in a circumstance in which they can speak up, as many of these brave women have done in these more high-profile cases. And I do think we need to pay attention at that end of the what I call the socioeconomic scale, because those women still, they have no place to make their complaint. If they do make a complaint, they have no protection at all because they're not going to get any publicity.
Is there overreach now? Should Al Franken have resigned the Senate?
Well, I don't feel myself qualified to say whether he should have resigned or not. The fact is that he has resigned. And as for overreaction, I know what you're talking about. There are a number of people who say, well, with the pendulum swinging back the other way, one, some innocent people could be accused of things that aren't true. Number two, there's the danger of false equivalency, that not all acts of sexual harassment are equivalent. There is a difference between a man in his 30s dating a 14-year-old girl and a man having his picture taken in a way that he shouldn't have. But I want to make clear, I'm not defending Al Franken. I'm not defending anybody who's been involved with this. I am saying that the important thing for us is to recognize that this is a moment of sea change and we need to make the best of it because our mothers and sisters and daughters deserve it.
Finally, Dan Rather, I grew up with you on TV and I remember in the mid-80s you would sign off of the CBS Evening News with the word courage. Your latest book, What Unites Us, focuses on some other words, too, and you've mentioned some of them, empathy, humility, and others. If you were signing off of CBS News today, given all that's going on today, what word would you leave us with?
Courage.
Still.
Still. My superiors insisted I back off of it when I tried it in the 1980s. But it was my father's favorite word, and I think particularly these days, it's a word that's applicable to our current situation. But, you know, this is a very hypothetical question because I'm not likely to be anchoring anybody's evening news again anytime soon. But I will be writing my heart on Facebook and with our News and Guts Center. It's a far cry from being on television every night and speaking to millions of people, but I've really been humbled by the response to Facebook and social media as a whole. And I've been surprised to the point of being astounded at the reach, the number of people you can reach with posts on Facebook and News and Guts. And believe you me, I'm grateful for every one of them.
Dan Rather, thank you for coming to Seattle. Thanks for this time together.
Thank you, Bill. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and we're tweeting at KUOW. Follow along with the show, if you will. Now, last week, we introduced you to a local doctor who's studying the effect of racial slights, an accumulation of racial microtraumas on the human body. Dr. Roberto Montenegro is a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow at Seattle Children's Hospital. Welcome back, Roberto.
Thank you for having me.
After we met you last week, we asked our Facebook followers to tell us about microtraumas in the workplace. And Everett says, when I'm the only black person in a business meeting and after the meeting someone says, you're so well-spoken. What do you expect from someone in my position? I bet they didn't tell the other white people in the meeting that they're well-spoken. Everett goes on to say, one, this is not the first time someone white has said this, and usually on the streets it comes with, you don't talk ghetto. Two, I have never heard this from a minority colleague. Three, I'm an average presenter. Roberto, what physiological effects have you found these kinds of things can have? This is the work you do.
Right. So what we're looking at is really the accumulation of these types of experiences. And we're examining the way that different biological markers have in the accumulation of these events. And specifically, we're looking at how consistent stress from these events, how these change particular cell types in the cell body, specifically known as telomeres, which are good markers for premature aging, how they affect stress response hormones like cortisol, for example, and how they affect different receptors in our bodies, and specifically serotonin reuptake inhibitor serotonin reuptake receptors, which are associated with anxiety and depression. And our work is still very early in the process, but there is a lot of work already showing that the repeated experience of being alienated, being dismissed, being invalidated, and does take a toll and is believed to have a great impact in the mental health and biological health and overall well-being of people.
Another listener reacted to Everett's post on Facebook. Elizabeth identified herself as a white woman and says, I think that interpreting it as aggression is misguided, and thank you is a way to handle any compliment, whether you like the statement or not. I think there are bigger things to concern ourselves with than people's off-base, yet sincere compliments. What's your response to that?
That's a very good and typical response that I would expect in individuals who aren't too familiar or haven't experienced many microaggressions themselves. There's a growing amount of literature on responses like this, where an individual, typically a white individual, reacts defensively, guarded, dismissive, and basically very uncomfortable to the idea that an individual may have been being a racist individual or making a racist comment. And this kind of fragility, I think we mentioned it last week a little bit. Dr. D'Angelo has coined this term as white fragility.
Robin D'Angelo has been a guest on our show. Yes.
That's correct. Yeah. So.
And what is it about the focus on, you said someone doesn't want to be called racist. It seems like you're trying to focus on the physiological effect, whatever the aggressor thinks or whatever the comment issuer thinks. You're looking at the effect on the person who deals with this time after time after time.
That's right. And so the important thing to emphasize here is that I don't want to place the onus of dealing with these types of discriminatory behaviors on the recipient. And part of the work that I'm also doing is trying to increase the amount of receptiveness and having these difficult conversations and sort of empowering individuals, either sexual minorities, gender minorities, or racial ethnic minorities, with skills that will allow them to be able to confront these topics or these experiences while also feeling managing the dismissiveness of white fragility.
What is one of those skills?
So there are several skills, and I think one of the things to really keep in mind is that it varies for every individual. There are some individuals who, like the person who posted on Facebook, has been experiencing this for years and years, they might not feel empowered to be able to address this type of discriminatory behavior. So, for example, a lot of the medical residents that I studied don't feel that they have the power to address a senior surgeon, for example. So at that point, they cannot engage in a conversation because they fear that they'll have institutional retaliation. Whereas other individuals who do feel that they have the support, who feel that they can have a safe conversation without retaliation, they can approach this using what we're trying to do here is develop a framework from dialectical behavior therapy, which is
pioneered at the University of Washington, by the way.
That's correct. So we're using aspects from DBT to help the recipient come up with a framework where they can keep a difficult conversation going while managing each other's emotional reactivity to this topic.
Okay, well, that sounds like a lot. I have to learn about dialectical behavioral therapy. Can you boil down one piece of advice for someone who's got to figure out how to handle these little incidents?
Okay, sure. So the first thing to ask is it worth it? Is confronting the person really worth it, personally, professionally? If the answer is yes, then being able to confront this in a safe environment where you know the person will be open, humble, and engaged and willing to become more educated. I think those three things are really important: humility, engagement, and education, with topics like white fragility and microaggressions and microtraumas. These are very uncomfortable topics, and the discomfort is important.
Emily writes on Facebook, in a team-building meeting, someone asked me if my personality traits were somehow related to the color of my skin. The worst part was that when she asked the question, stumbling on her words, she paused and pointed to her skin. I was caught off guard and embarrassed, but mostly for her. Is that good advice? Don't be embarrassed for yourself. Be embarrassed for the other person.
Well, it depends. Sometimes in some of these situations, again, from a dialectical perspective, it does help to keep both realities in mind, to keep the idea that this person was probably very embarrassed and this person may have not been embarrassed at all. And staying somewhere in the middle, being able to manage both views is very helpful in difficult situations like this.
Yeah, rather than read their minds.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sarah is a medical lab scientist. She says on Facebook, when I go into a hardware store to buy a new belt for my vacuum in my scrubs, and the guy working there asking me if I am a house cleaner and if it wouldn't be easier to buy a new vacuum, the new drive belt costs $10. Any advice for Sarah?
I think this is very similar to a lot of the other microaggressions. It's really hard to tell intent. So I think that an important aspect with dealing with microaggressions and microtraumas is not necessarily succumbing to the argument of you're being too sensitive. This is a compliment. And trying to figure out, or mind read, like you said, the person's intent. Rather, just continue to protect yourself and do what you need to keep yourself healthy, which if it means that you have to walk away, then to keep yourself healthy, then walk away. You don't have to feel like you have to confront every aggression that you experience.
We have a question on Twitter right now. At KOWK wants to know, is it correct children are especially vulnerable to long-term impact from this traua? And you work with young people, doctor.
I do work with children as well. And that's something that still needs to be determined in terms of perceived trauma from discrimination. Perceived trauma in general is definitely something that impacts children quite profusely and in many different ways. And I think that's another area of interest for me is the way that this impacts the mental health of children as well. We've seen a lot of research in college-age children, but college-age adolescents, but not in children necessarily.
What about the general advice to children? We've heard before, I've said some version of this, that you can't control what somebody else says, thinks. You can only control your own attitude. You know, don't let it, sticks and stones, that kind of thing. You know, you've got to be strong and not feel attacked. They're just other people's words.
Mm. Another great point. So we, using a lot of cognitive behavior therapy with dialectical behavior therapy, we are developing a way of approaching this with younger kids, especially in the kids I work with in the gender clinic and transgender clinic, where a lot of the microaggressions of being misread or the incorrect pronouns being used, I personally see the impact this has in a young child's life and their mental health with repeatedly being otherized and not feeling that they're able to identify the way that they identify themselves. And constantly, as they commonly explain to me, being reminded that they are not the person that they are. So again, being otherized. And the way that we are encouraging these kiddos to address this is, again, you can't control what other people say to a certain extent, especially in children. You can control your thoughts, and you can control the distortions that you have that are being fueled by a lot of the hurt and the trauma that you're experiencing. But ultimately, let's teach you how to control that thoughts that will prevent you from escalating or magnifying. Now, with adults, the argument of you can't control what other people say, that changes. As adults, silence and ignoring either overt or covert forms of discrimination are just unacceptable and really something that keeps perpetuating the problems of systemic racism.
We're talking with Dr. Roberto Montenegro, child and adolescent psychiatry fellow at Seattle's Children's Hospital. What about advice for people who would like to avoid inflicting micro-traumas or microaggressions? Stephanie writes, I think she was on the receiving end. She writes on Facebook, "How much native are you?" is an annoying question that comes up frequently. Seriously, ask yourselves why some people feel it's appropriate to ask this question. What advice would you give to somebody who's curious and doesn't want to be rude?
I think being able to openly be humble and respectful of what your comments may, the impact your comments may have in someone else's life is important to keep in mind. Now, the thing with microaggressions is that most oftentimes they are unintentional. And it's about having the humility of being open to feedback when someone actually approaches you, if they have it in them at that point to approach you and let you know what you've just said made me feel XYZ or assumed XYZ, and this is why it was inappropriate. Acknowledging that you will mess up from time to time is super important and challenges the paradigm of hierarchy within how race was politically and socially constructed. So being okay with being challenged and being okay knowing that you will either aggress or be the aggressor at some point and that you will fluctuate is very important.
Vic says, white people automatically trying to talk to me in Spanish. I'm American as hell. You don't sound educated and empathetic. You show me you live on assumptions.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing to emphasize with this example is that I argue that it's not necessarily only a white, non-white phenomenon. Sue, who's one of the psychologists who's further developed this concept from which initiated with Chester Pierce in the 70s and has started to add additional components to this. So there is ableness. There are differences by sex, gender, orientation, SES, a lot of other factors. So a lot of these examples are facing or are really capturing gender and race. And there are a host of other factors that we inadvertently continue to offend other people. And offense is not, again, hurting someone's feelings, but making assumptions and alienating and dismissing.
I think when I was a kid, it was sticks and stones can break your bones and words will never hurt you. My guest, Roberto Montenegro, studies the physical effects of the accumulation of slights, as you say, racial and otherwise. Roberto Montenegro is an MD, PhD, a fellow in Seattle Children's Hospital Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program. Dr. Montenegro, thanks for coming back, talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. In a moment, we're going to talk about what future civilizations ought to know about you and me. A podcast accumulates the stuff that should never be forgotten. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. So a half hour ago, Dan Rather's telling you that the U.S. is in an existential crisis. Existential! And when your existence is threatened, it's time to make a podcast. My next guests are acting to preserve our cultural history so future civilizations will know us after our way of life has collapsed. The podcast is called Omnibus, and the hosts are former Jeopardy ace Ken Jennings and singer-songwriter, former Seattle City Council candidate John Roderick. Hi, fellas.
Hey, Bill.
So good to be here. You know, we're both Seattleites and longtime multiple appearance guests on this program.
So. FOS, friend of the show.
Yeah, so we feel like we're right at home.
Well, I want to know why a future civilization should know that we throw people out of windows.
The second show is indeed about the history, particularly in Central Europe, of Czech people throwing political enemies out of windows. The conceit
actually
of the
bouncing checks, as you
oh yeah, there was a. That's, I had to hear that joke twice.
A second time.
No one's going to listen to it now that they've heard all the puns, Bill.
Sorry.
Thanks. The conceit of the podcast is that we're speaking to people in a distant civilization after some kind of cataclysm has wiped out what we know of Earth. And John and I feel that we are uniquely qualified to compile an authoritative reference work of what needs to survive, including apparently throwing people out of windows in Czechoslovakia.
Sure, everybody's...
Well, what uniquely qualified you for that?
Well, here's the thing.
Mostly self-appointed.
Right. I mean, when you're someone who lives in a world sort of governed by an interest in ephemera, which both of us are. I mean, Ken managed to turn that into a career.
He knows a lot.
Yeah.
His show has been right here.
He's Mr. Knows-a-Lot guy.
No, it's the Jeopardy domination is still a big deal.
It's Sir Knows-a-Lot, actually.
Sorry.
You get knighted by Alex at some point.
Yeah, it's like he won a gold medal in the Olympics of knowing things.
Yeah.
But it's not really a skill that's useful beyond sort of cocktail party, wowing people.
Annoying people.
And when we met one another and became friends, we had this sort of mutual admiration society of we got each other's references.
Who was more of a fan of the other?
I think a pre-existing Long Winters fan.
I'd never heard of
John
Ken.
Enjoyed Jeopardy, ironically.
But I was waiting in line at a restaurant and the people there seemed to know who he was.
Oh, so, got it. Yeah.
John's always impressed when very elderly people recognize me.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of my level of celebrity.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, he's super big at assisted living facilities.
And Hallmark stores. And John is actually kind of the Jeopardy champion of rock musicians. I mean, everyone knows I'm the rock star of Quiz Show Champ.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But John's definitely the intellectual peak of his field as well. So this podcast is where the Venn diagram intersects.
Lol.
I see. So is there, first of all, are you taking listener suggestions? Because we're tweeting at KOW. Maybe people will toss historical esoterica at you.
Absolutely.
You consider?
I mean, the idea is that there's a top level of information that's going to survive the apocalypse, right? I mean, the Library of Alexandria burned, but still we did manage to get some of the Greek plays.
Sure. And so in the future, everybody's going to know who Abraham Lincoln is, you know?
Yeah. But we're creating kind of a Norwegian seed bank of lesser known varieties.
Yes.
Ideas that might not make it all the way through. So the Beatles surely will survive any apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
But will the animals?
We just did a show on 1950s tearjerker teen ballads because we were afraid that, you know, what if Leader of the Pack and Teen Angel don't survive the meteor strike?
Right.
You know?
Beethoven's Fifth will be around,
sure.
but you're getting at the
but
small
what about
varietals.
What about novelty right. songs? We don't know.
Yeah. Right.
You cannot know our culture without knowing the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
So we're making an ark just for Gordon Lightfoot songs, apparently.
An unsinkable ark, one right. hopes. Why will the future want to know about the pig war of San Juan Island?
I think you should field this one. John's our beloved local historian.
Well, I think part of it is the future is going to be trying to reconstruct what happened. Why did 21st century America precipitate a global catastrophe? Why did the wheels come off so badly?
Mm.
And I think you won't be able to really be able, from 2,000 years from now, we're talking about a super intelligent coral reef, which has become sentient and is now consuming the past.
And enjoys podcasting.
And enjoys podcasts. How, you know, as they're trying to piece it together, we're adding that crucial bit of like, well, the lace on the doily, if you will.
The doily of civilization.
Yeah. So that they'll be able to look back and say, did Jennifer Aniston's haircut on the mid-90s sitcom Friends play some sort of butterfly in China role in the decline and fall of Western civilization?
I see. They want to know, the sentient coral reef wants to know about the Rachel.
We feel like there's a pedagogical purpose.
Yes.
You know? Like there's lessons to be learned from the Rachel or the pig war or whatever it is. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, maybe, and even for listeners now, you know, looking at these things from an imaginary future point of view, you know, you can take the outsider's long view and maybe see them through fresh eyes.
Some people are Googling the pig war, but for your convenience, this has to do with how the boundary between the U.S. and Canada snakes around the San Juan Islands. You may have seen the British camp there, or whatever they call it, the English camp, the American camp.
Yeah,
the San Juans.
The English government believed the San Juans belonged to what became Canada, and we obviously disagreed.
When they drew the line at the 49th parallel, they said it would follow the channel. Unfortunately, there's two channels in the San Juan.
Three channels.
So exactly.
Get your arrow straight.
Right.
Not clear where San Juan Island falls. And that almost led to a shooting war between the U.S. and Great Britain in the mid-19th century, you know, decades after the War of 1812.
Are you trying to keep the blemishes on the official portrait? Like, you were talking about throwing people out of windows and almost killing each other over a pig. What are you telling the future about us?
It's not all about contention.
Okay.
It's, as we examine sort of the things that pique our own interest, right? We're both encyclopedia reading kids who were introduced to the internet at a time when we'd already been reading encyclopedias our whole life. So hyperlinking and chasing threads was something instinctive to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, we have a lifetime of context to be able to leapfrog around and say like, that fits in here. The defenestrations of Prague actually led to the 30 Years' War, and that's an interesting connection to make.
And that's part of it. The contentiousness is part of us, but also the idea that someone would go to all that trouble to bring Shakespeare's bird reference into North America. That's an important part of us, too, right? If you want to understand our time, it's good to know both aspects of our personality.
When I read about the past, I do enjoy like the little personal touches, the anecdotes, the esoterica. And I feel like, you know, you can do that about introducing the starling to Central Park and thereby destroying North America's bird ecosystem.
Somebody thought we should have every bird that Shakespeare references ought to be in North America.
Well, I think that's self-evident. You know, you don't want to be missing one bird from Henry IV. Like, how embarrassing would that be?
And he imported 30 birds, and now there are 300 million starlings in the United States.
He basically destroyed a whole ecosystem because of one line in Henry IV, Part One.
And that wasn't intentional, but it is hubris.
And it's an illuminating look at how the dominoes of the past kind of fall sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to need to know that after the sea levels rise.
I did want to ask you, is there something that is making you fear for our civilization that motivated this podcast?
We're not gloomy on the show.
Not at all.
But no. It's certainly not.
The subtext.
It's certainly not arbitrary that 2017 might be a year when some of us are thinking more than usual about what might succeed the human race. But I think people in all eras have enjoyed, you know, in some weird level, the idea that, well, what about the zombies? What about the epidemic? What about, people imagining, I guess, apocalypse porn?
The thing is that we are trying to compile this now, because as Ken says, you don't want to start your podcast when the meteor is in the sky.
You want to have a few shows in the can.
So we're not anticipating that the world will end before the new year. We're bunkering. We're getting ready.
We certainly want to make sure it doesn't end before we see our first, advertiser check.
That's right.
Right.
We have that in mind as well.
Our bunker isn't completely kitted out, so we do need to generate some revenue
in the present.
Yeah,
yeah.
We might need mattresses or who knows.
Who's listening to you guys? I got sentient coral reef, but you've thought this through, like who your audience is. Every podcaster needs to know who their audience is, so you can micro target those beings.
typically we think of, I think in the 21st century, we think of giant, a race of giant cockroaches, which has, you know, gained the use of their mandibles to put on old gold records left behind by destroyed civilizations.
Mm-hmm. They're radiation proof.
But as we've thought more and more about it, it really could be, I mean, life takes surprising turns. So Ken likes to speculate that maybe it's an alien invader or an artificial intelligence.
Sure, it could be the sentient computer network that went nuts and got the missile codes. Maybe it's our only listener. But if so, it's a very prestigious one, I guess.
That is the demographics there. You really want to capture that segment.
Yeah,
when there's only one being.
I don't know if they're interested in stamps.com or whatever, but you know, we do have 100% of life on Earth, maybe.
And what do you imagine the cockroaches or the coral reef or the alien cloud thinking of us as they get to know us through your podcast?
I mean, we think of ourselves as so, I don't know, sort of brittle and doomed, but we want the future to look upon us generously and kindly. Obviously, we're wreaking havoc on the planet now. And
they may not be predisposed to love us just by virtue of the circumstances of their birth.
That's right. But they may also be the product of an admixture of DNA that we flushed down the toilet that never would have had a chance to combine into a new life form until we invented all this extra plumbing.
I love the idea that we might be gifting them nostalgia. You know, like not just affection for our times, but what if they suddenly have the same warm feelings about mid-90s Jennifer Aniston haircuts that we do now? That would be a gift.
And we're bonding over that. And we are the civilization. We are the species that invented throwing people out of windows and yet didn't do it all the time.
Right.
That's something.
Yep, absolutely.
It's an admirable restraint.
We restrained ourselves. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. How do you feel about having your ancestor involved in maybe America's most famous defenestration?
It's true. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was in the room when Mormon founder Joseph Smith got thrown out a window.
Jumped or fell.
There's a long discussion of what constitutes defenestration.
It's true. He was not pushed out the window. He was shot from both in or out of the room and then fell.
Yeah.
Was he technically defenestrated?
Pushed, jumped, tripped, or was shot so well that he actually like slow motion backwards went out the window.
And my ancestor was at the door banging people with a hickory stick, apparently ineffectively.
The rascal beater.
Called the rascal beater at the time. So my ancestor did everything he could to prevent America's, you know, greatest defenestration. But to no avail, defenestrator is going to defenestrate, you know?
Heard that.
Future species are feeling better about themselves with every episode of the podcast Omnibus. And how are you going to preserve the podcast?
That's an open question.
We've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Obviously, the etching it into platinum discs.
Like the Voyager 2 probe, you know, sending out human and animal sound effects out to the stars in hopes that Alpha Centauri wants to hear what a loon sounds like or whatever.
We do not trust the cloud, and yet perhaps the cloud itself will gain sentience and retain this in some, like, vestigial memory that we can shake loose. We may just have to, like, I don't know, embed it in mustard packets and disseminate it through fast food restaurants around the globe.
What if we're the innovation that awakes the cloud that finally gives it enough perspective to come alive? Like, right. That would be a little off-putting.
We're trying a lot of things.
You're throwing a lot of things against the wall. In the minute we have left, do you know of any future episodes? Are you soliciting future episodes of stuff that the future will know of us?
Oh, yeah, we want to cast a wide net. Okay. We sort of feel like we're the voice of a species here.
Right.
And it's a democracy. We want the human race to tell us what should last.
That's right. We find things all the time, but we have a voracious appetite, always have. And bouncing off one another, obviously we have very different interests. But if we could solicit contributions from, well, certainly the population of Seattle—
Public radio listeners? Is there a better audience for something like this?
Like, I think not.
We're lucky to have them.
A collective intelligence.
At KOW if you're tweeting, and we'll get it there. John Roderick writes songs and sings songs with the Long Winters, sometimes runs for office. Mm-hmm. And Ken Jennings knows a lot of stuff and writes books. And together, they're knocking their heads together and communicating to the cockroaches with Omnibus, the new podcast. Fellas, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The Record on KUOW. You're going to feel so much better about yourselves, cockroaches, when you take a listen to Omnibus. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening to The Record, a show put together by Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Von Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Andel. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. Let's do it again tomorrow.